Indiana has a severe housing shortage for the lowest income Hoosiers. Looking ahead to next week's primary, plus Tim Brown's campaign finance questions and more on Indiana Week in Review for the week ending April 29th, 2022.
Indiana Week in Review is made possible by the supporters of Indiana Public Broadcasting Stations.
This week, nearly three-quarters of the lowest-income Hoosiers have to spend at least half of their income on housing. That's the worst rate in the Midwest and 13th worst in the country. The data comes from a housing shortage report by the National Low-Income Housing Coalition and Prosperity Indiana. The report defines extremely low income as households making 30% or less of the area median income. In Indiana, that's about $26,000 for a family of four. Prosperity Indiana Policy Director Andrew Bradley says Indiana has a shortage of more than 135,000 affordable rental homes for that population.
So that's where you see where employers are saying they're having a hard time finding warehouse workers or service workers, home health care provider workers. They may not be able to afford to live, to move to, or stay in those communities.
Bradley says addressing that shortage requires an all-of-the-above strategy that includes creative ways for communities to meet the need.
And that includes things like land banks, which is where community partners come together to clear blight and make parcels available for affordable housing units.
Bradley notes that the largest proportion of extremely low-income households are working families. How can Indiana address this critical housing shortage? It's the first question for our Indiana Week in Review panel. Democrat Ann Delaney. Republican Mike O'Brien. John Schwanis, host of Indiana Lawmakers. And Nikki Kelly, statehouse reporter for the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. I'm Indiana Public Broadcasting State House reporter Brandon Smith. Mike O'Brien, can this be left to the private sector to solve?
No, it can't. I don't think it's for a number of reasons. We heard about the housing shortage in Indiana. The current economy is inflated. Home values plus inflation diminishes the value of the dollar you earn to begin with. Fundamentally, you're not earning enough money. And that is something that the state has tried to address for years. And it unsuccessfully in many ways, and successfully in some. You can point to data that has the highest, you know, the new jobs that are being created or the new jobs that are in the pipeline at IADC have the highest wage that we've ever had. But fundamentally, we've come up short in what Mitch Daniels originally set out to do, which was raise Hoosier incomes and focus, a focus we've lost in a lot of ways, which was his charge originally, and focus on those people who are kind of on the first rung of the economic ladder. There's also, some, you know, Central Indiana, I work with an organization on the east side that does a number of things, Shepherd Community Center, that does a number of things for people in those zip codes on the east side. One of them is to try to provide affordable housing. And one thing they're seeing now is as houses go on the market that they would otherwise buy and rehab and refit so they're livable, they're losing to out-of-state investment groups that are snapping them up in seconds because the algorithm, they have these algorithms down that they're picking these things up for cash. Yeah. And it's really putting it's changing the mission, right? It expands the gentrification to downtown and it's some of these communities. So that's a problem too. So it's a problem in a lot of different areas. That's going to require not just us saying Republicans or whoever saying, well, the market will figure it out.
This is a big problem. This is a big ship to turn. What is something that the state of Indiana can do in the more immediate future to help address this?
There are a lot of things the state of Indiana can do. I mean, for example, they could have adopted a living wage a long time ago, but didn't. They could have put money into tax credits. That's what it takes to do these kinds of low-income problems. We did one when I was at the Julian Center, and we had tax credits. They were federal tax credits. They aren't there anymore. And the state could do something similar with that. We also need tenants' rights. I mean, we have the highest eviction rate in the Midwest in addition to these things. You have people living in substandard conditions that present problems. If we could get stable housing for people that was affordable, performance in school would go up. People wouldn't be relocating every 3 months because the housing they're living in is substandard. They don't have water. They don't have heat, or they can't afford the rent. And those things would have a ripple effect that would be positive on the community. But that's where it takes initiative. And this is what I've been complaining about with the Republican supermajorities for years. Their approach is cut taxes, Nothing else. That's all we do is cut taxes. We don't look at the problems. We don't look at the quality of life. We don't look at how to make Indiana a better place. We complain that there aren't enough people for the jobs at the low end of the scale that are available, but we don't take the steps to make those opportunities really affordable for people. It's just a total lack of vision.
We just talked last week about what Eli Lilly CEOs said about Indiana falling behind in some of these competitive areas when it comes to quality of life issues. This seems to get to some of that. But is one of the, Notre Dame Student Policy Group came out with a report this week that also said that, yes, Indiana passed this eviction expungement for some eviction filings, which was a great step. But Indiana is one of only five states that doesn't have repair and deduct legislation, right, which is where if your landlord isn't addressing a problem, you can either withhold your rent or you can fix it and then deduct that from your rent. Is the legislature need to get out of the way of some of these problems by just following along with the rest of the country?
Well, yeah, and there's no one silver bullet, like right. No
Absolutely.
One thing that's going to fix it. You know, you can talk about tax credits. You can talk about taking unused commercial property and turning it into, like, strip malls that are all sitting there. And there are other states who are turning those into, you know, small affordable apartments housing. For affordable housing, things like that. You can also, like, we have this affordable housing website, and we can see where there are our needs. There's also a little bit of the not in my backyard stuff going on. And there are zoning rules, little things that have to do that are driving those costs up for things, stuff like requiring a parking space for every, you know, person who lives there and things like that. Those things are driving all those costs up. And to be fair, there's probably a little bit of leftover from the pandemic when those landlords, you know, with the eviction moratorium, you know, some people went for a year and didn't get money. So they're also charging higher rents, trying to charge three times. You know, you have to make three times your income to get into their slots because they got burned a little too.
This is obviously, as Nikki just said, as Mike talked about, there's no one thing here. There's a lot that needs to be done on the governmental side, on the private sector side. But from the governmental side, we talked, again, going back to that conversation last week about, does the Indiana General Assembly respond to some of the criticisms from groups like Eli Lilly? If this stuff starts to really pile up, and I would argue it already has, but if stuff like this report and all these other things start to pile up, does that begin to change minds?
Well, I think it would first have to undo some of the things that it has done, I'm referring to the General Assembly, that contributed to the problem. It's not just that they have not been active in shoring up the finances of people who are at risk of being homeless or helping encourage the development of affordable housing. They actually, I think, have gone the other direction. And I hadn't thought about this until the discussion, but I'll do my best from memory here. In Bloomington, which is, by the way, the most affordable or the least affordable leasing in the state of Indiana, more than Carmel, but in any case, those who are familiar with Bloomington, the old Dunhill apartment complex, famous thing immediately west of Memorial Stadium. When a Chicago-based firm redeveloped that area, and it's now completely different, big 500-car garage, et cetera, the city of Bloomington had a program where it was able to extract, as part of the rezoning and the approval process, a payment. I want to say, and again, I haven't thought about this for years, maybe $1 million from that developer to go into an affordable housing fund in Bloomington. After that, the General Assembly didn't like what it saw, and I believe now one of the many preemptions that it has sought and enacted in other years. Plastic bags in grocery stores weren't the only ordinance that got under their skin. I believe that this notion of forcing developers to pay for affordable housing as a prerequisite for getting the zoning approval and the green light for the project. So that was an instance. I think the last time that mechanism was used was by Bloomington and is no longer available to cities because of the General Assembly.
Right. Well, speaking of the General Assembly, more Indiana State House lawmakers face primary challenges this year than any election in more than a decade. There are 26 Indiana House or Senate races that include at least one incumbent this year. That's the most since 2008, when there were 28. A few of those contested seats feature two incumbents, something that's not unusual after a redistricting year. And most of the incumbent challenges are on the Republican side, again, not that unusual in such a GOP-dominated state. Incumbent losses in the primary aren't common in Indiana. There's typically no more than one or two per election. There are no statewide election results to watch Tuesday night. The U.S. Senate primaries are uncontested between incumbent Republican Todd Young and Democratic challenger Tom McDermott. There are three other statewide elected positions on the ballot this fall, Secretary of State, Auditor, and Treasurer, but the candidates for those races are chosen at the state political party conventions several weeks from now. And Delaney, should a lot more incumbents than usual be worried?
Well, I think more incumbents. I don't know if it's a lot more, but certainly, I mean, you've got two districts where you have two incumbents running against each other, so obviously two of them are going to lose. And then you have other
ones. Actually three.
Three. Yeah,
it's actually three.
There's one in the Senate, but there's two appointed state senators. One was appointed, Kevin Bayline, and another guy was appointed in the middle of the Senate.
Yeah, two in the House, one in the Senate.
They're kind of incumbents.
Okay. They are technically incumbents. They counted on my list.
And then, you know, if Representative Jacobs wins, it's not going to be because the Republican caucus didn't dump, what?
$600,000.
Is it $600,000? I was thinking it was more like $750,000. Every time I turn on the TV, the life, liberty, and the rule of law, except for Roe v. Wade, is on there. So I haven't seen anything from Representative Jacobs. So, there are one or two others, I think, that are at risk. I don't think certainly all 26, but I think we're going to see more turnover than we have. And the question is, does it go farther to the right on the Republican side? Or do we get some people that actually have a brain and want to get something done? I don't know the answer to that.
I think the most in the last decade or so that have lost, the most incumbents that have lost in a primary are three. So obviously you're going to get some because some incumbents have to lose because they're facing incumbents. But those notwithstanding, do we top three incumbents losing this cycle?
You could, yeah. And I think the House Republican Caucus has taken it seriously on some of these people that are running against incumbents and are running far to the right. The House Republican Caucus does not have a policy that they protect incumbents exclusively, right? They will pick, they will get involved on the primary side, and they've gotten involved in a very big way. I've never seen, and my doubt has been seen in modern Indiana politics. And you also see other organizations, whether they're trade associations or others, that typically have policies that say we're staying out of primaries, are getting in because the prospect of a lot of these people winning who are so far, it's not even how far to the right anymore. It's how tethered are you to reality and reasonableness, they see some of these candidates and go, we can't afford to just say, well, we'll stay out, because the downside to losing a few of these is so bad, it's far worse than being on the wrong side.
Let me ask you this, John. Even if it's double the highest number of incumbents losing, not counting the incumbent versus incumbent races, even if it's double, which was six, they would of course be in districts that almost certainly would mean their victory in November. Six of these people in the Indiana House Republican Caucus out of what's still likely to be around 70, does that make that big a difference?
I think it can potentially make that big a difference, depending on the issue. Even if it doesn't decide an issue, you know, one way or the other, whether you see more red lights on the tote board or more green lights. But what it could do is mean that the agenda is to a large extent shaped by these newly elected members in that they have certain social issues that they are adamant about. They have, whether it's critical race theory, whether it's abortion, there are lots of things that, as far as they're concerned, that's the one thing they're there to do. And it could make it more difficult to address some of the issues, the fiscal issues, the quality of life issues, the infrastructure, and I use that term broadly, social infrastructure, medical and health infrastructure that the governor, for instance, is interested in pursuing and has indicated in this next budget session that's what he wants to do. So it just means more herding of the cats in terms of the speaker who already probably has one of the toughest jobs in town.
I read that. He hasn't heard these. They excluded him from the caucus. Like John Jacob and Curtin Isaac do not caucus with House Republicans, and now they've created this Liberty caucus that's running a number of these people.
I mean, these primaries. Are we looking at another caucus?
You look at this kind of coalition, outside of the traditional caucus structure.
Nikki, I was reading an AP story this morning about this Liberty caucus group that's funding a lot of these candidates around the state, and Representative Dan Leonard, who has one of these Liberty Caucus candidates running against him, said basically was describing these people as all or nothing, both as candidates and as potential politicians, that, you know, they aren't interested in the kind of compromise we see even with a supermajority Republican at the state.
Well, it's absolutely fair. And we saw it for a great example of this during session was when they first introduced that vaccine mandate, employer mandate bill. We had all these people coming to session who were saying, no, just flat out ban it. Absolutely. No working.
And we accept nothing else.
No working. Yes. No working for, and same with ending the COVID emergency. Didn't want to make sure we get the federal money. So yeah, that's the thing. They are not interested in compromise or anything like that. Also, one thing from interviewing a number of these candidates is if other than that one, maybe it's abortion for someone, maybe it's transgender sports for another one, other than their one main issue, they really don't want to talk or know about anything else in state government. You know, like I'll ask them about tax cuts or, you know, the budget, and they just no clue, no idea. They are focused on one or two things, and that's it.
Bums me out. Time now for viewer feedback. Each week we pose an unscientific online poll question. This week's question, how many state house incumbents will lose in Indiana's primary election? Fewer than five, 5 to 10, or more than 10? Last week's question was, will Indiana fully legalize cannabis within the next 3 years? 41% of you say yes, 59% say no. I honestly don't know where I fall on that one. If you'd like to take part in the poll, go to wfyi.org/IWIR and look for the poll. Well, retiring Indiana House Republican Representative Tim Brown closed out his campaign account by paying himself nearly $30,000, money he says essentially didn't really exist. That's from a story this week by the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette's Nikki Kelly.
I've heard.
Brown is retiring after nearly 3 decades in the General Assembly, and to close out his campaign account, he sent $12,000 to the House Republican Campaign Committee, more than $3,000 to his wife, telling the Journal-Gazette it was reimbursement for a staff dinner, and gave himself the rest, a little less than $30,000. But Brown told Nikki Kelly that the $30,000 wasn't really in his account, saying the Indiana Election Division had me richer than I really was. In order to close a campaign account, there must be $0 left, and so he said he wrote off the remaining money as an expenditure to himself just to close the books, even though he says he didn't actually get a dime. Nikki Kelly, I couldn't come up with a better question than this. What the heck?
You know, let me tell you what. So I had done a bunch of research on sort of the rules for when you're allowed to pay yourself, you know, because there are some things you're allowed to pay yourself for. And if lost wages and this, and I call Doc Brown and I'm all ready. I was not ready for, I didn't actually get any money. It doesn't exist. And I was totally flummoxed.
And you call yourself a veteran journalist.
I know. So basically, somewhere along the way, there was massive communication errors, or I mean, it could be anything. Someone could have stole the money. He could have given it to someone and they, you know, forgot to note it. It could have been an in-kind contribution that was noted wrong. But the fact is, he didn't appear to care where that initial mistake was and how long it had been going on. His only answer was just to essentially file a fake report saying he got money when he didn't.
John Schwanis, in terms of people caring, how much is it going to be that, well, he's retiring, so meh?
Well, I think people care for the reasons that Nikki mentioned. And it's exacerbated by the fact that this is a fellow who spent the last decade as chair of the budget writing House Ways and Means
he knows how the money
Committee.
Works.
You would think that he knows which account to put it in the ledger. But as a practical matter, whether people care or not really doesn't matter because there are no repercussions. He's retiring. Even if nobody's filed, or at least as of the taping of this program, nobody has filed any complaint. Even if somebody files a complaint and the state, you know, election commission decides to pursue it, and they find that it was a fraudulent, or what was the word you used? It wasn't fraudulent.
False report.
False report. Whatever. a bogus report or whatever you call it. It's $100 fine, I think. And
he's got $30,000.
$30,000. Monopoly.
He could pay with Monopoly money,
or take it out of his wife's $3,000. I think she got for the meal. Right. So, people should care, because that's the validity of our electoral process. That's why we have transparency, so we can see how candidates are raising money and how they're spending money. That's the problem. But as a practical matter, so it doesn't matter.
So. If this was just a mistake in bookkeeping, if it can be resolved, that's great. But some of this could be, we'd like to know where this money went at the very least, right? Because, I mean, yeah, maybe it doesn't affect Tim Brown because he's retiring, but if that money went to somebody else or came from somebody else, that could be somebody who's still involved in Indiana's political scene.
Sure, ideally. I think, having been around this process for a long time, I've seen all kinds of these campaign finance. They're not like fraudulent violations. They're just like, it's just like sometimes the intern didn't input it correctly, or you accepted in-kind that isn't actually money, and you didn't report as an expense, which isn't actually money, but it's in and out in the report as actual money. So it can get away from you if you, especially particularly if you have an error that was years ago, yeah. And you're trying to unwind it, and then every filing you make from that point is relative to the incorrect filing from whatever it was.
Yeah, I mean, it literally could be years and years.
So the average person is going to say, what do you mean the money didn't exist? Well, there are circumstances where there is no money, right, in a campaign finance report.
It could be just that. It could be the in-kind, but it's hard to see how you'd have a $30,000 in-kind contribution in one report. So it probably has been a pattern of conduct that they've done incorrectly for a number of years. Does it matter in that regard? Probably not, except that when you like to have the I's dotted and the T's crossed, and he was chairman of the Ways and Means Committee, and this wasn't his first rodeo.
No, he's been around the State House
for a couple
years. He's
been around a long
years.
Time. you would think he would, if that's all it was a simple little mistake, it could have been corrected a long time ago.
All right, well, Indiana Attorney General Todd Rokita is taking a major Black Lives Matter organization to court. The Republican official wants a judge to compel the group to produce documents he's been asking for. Now, while Black Lives Matter is a movement, it's also the name of several organizations around the world, and one of the foremost is the Black Lives Matter Global Network Foundation, which was founded in 2013. It has chapters around the country, including in Indiana. Rokita started an investigation into the Global Foundation a couple months ago, seeking information about how the group was using donations made by Hoosiers. Now, the Attorney General is taking BLM to court because he says it hasn't turned over requested documents. Rokita alleges that the organization said it raised over $90 million in 2020 and shared some of those resources with chapters that included South Bend, but reported to the IRS that year that it had $0 in revenue, expenses, and assets. A group of BLM chapters has previously called for greater transparency from the Global Network Foundation. John Schwanis, this is Todd Rokita. So the first instinct says that this is political, but with Black Lives Matter affiliated groups also asking questions about transparency from this Global Foundation, does Todd Rokita have a point here?
Todd Rokita has a point. I think it's a very valid point. And I assume he's acting in his role as the chief consumer watchdog, which is part of his scope and role that he has been given by the state of Indiana. So he's not even stretching to address this issue. If, in fact, he's entitled to that information, you're entitled to that information, everybody watching and listening to the show is entitled to that information. For instance, if you're a nonprofit, you have to file your IRS 990 forms, which spell out a lot of the finances. That's just, you do it. And as I understand it from his office and the release that was put out, one of the various many things they asked for was their 990s. And presumably they're maybe on file somewhere, but you'd think if the attorney general in a state where you are trying to help people and raise money, perhaps, that you would heed I don't think there's been any response. Just a non-response.
Well, from the Global Foundation. Now, the South Bend chapter, which is the group sort of here at issue, because they received some money from this global group, they came out and said, we've already been talking with the Attorney General's office. We're cooperating fully. We believe in transparency. We have nothing to hide. We're working with them. So in terms of the politics of this, How does this shake out for everybody involved?
Yeah, I don't know. I mean, I do think it helps to have a judge involved then, because it takes a little of the political out of it. It's not just one person demanding another group's, you know, a liberal group's, you know, paperwork, so to speak. At least there'll be a judge to review. So to get another name in there, another person to review the likelihood of any issues that Todd Rokita might find.
And very quickly, does Todd Rokita have a point here? Is this a case where he's doing the right thing?
He may have a point, but I'm sure that if his motive is not political, that the next thing he's going to do is demand the same records from the NRA, because we all know that there have been misappropriations of funds from the NRA, and we have a chapter in Indiana, don't we?
And we know that because they were prosecuted for that.
Well, I know, but
that's why we have that information.
We should all see the records.
I'm guessing they're not.
He should be in court.
Are on file, I'd have to assume, but.
Well, that's probably how we found out about some of that. All right, that's Indiana Week in Review for this week. Our panel is Democrat Ann Delaney, Republican Mike O'Brien, John Schwannis of Indiana Lawmakers, and Nikki Kelly of the Fort Wayne Journal-Gazette. If you'd like a podcast of this program, you can find it at WFYI.org/IWIR, or starting Monday, you can stream it or get it on demand from Xfinity and on the WFYI app. I'm Brandon Smith of Indiana Public Broadcasting. Join us next time, because a lot can happen in an Indiana week.
The opinions expressed are solely those of the panelists. Indiana Week in Review is a WFYI production in association with Indiana's public broadcasting stations.